Right, so I would like to talk again about the characteristic of non-self in regard to Vipassana meditation. And the whole topic of anatta, non-self, of course, does breed a lot of interest and a lot of confusion. It's an absolutely fundamental aspect of the Buddhist teaching that if you are practicing Vipassana meditation, you do need to know, do need to understand. There is a lot of confusion about it, so I'm either going to clarify or I'm going to make even more confusing, but let's give it a go anyway. And I think some of this, I just want to reassure people that the discovery of the true nature of reality and that fundamentally there is no self does not mean that you'll disappear in a puff of blue smoke. It's not a nihilistic teaching at all. That's a complete misunderstanding. It is entirely. I do understand that people find it confusing. I found it confusing. But with patience, time, and application to real practice, so not just thinking about it, that's not going to change anything, but real, genuine practice of insight meditation, you can come to a complete comprehension of the true nature of reality. And I think, firstly, one of the problem is with the whole notion of selfhood is it is the fundamental axiom upon which our lives are built. And by axiomatic, I mean that it is a presupposition. It is an unquestioned assumption about the fundamental nature of reality, upon which then our whole narrative of our lives is built. So, of course, people aren't going to just go, "Oh, there's no self." Of course, there is no self. Huh, silly me. You know, we cling mightily to that notion because it is axiomatic, because it is an assumption that tells us that actually nobody really knows. If everyone knew for certain that there was a self, we would be able to point to it, we would be able to distinguish its fundamental characteristics, and so there would be absolutely no question and no doubt. But of course, the whole problem is, and why it engenders a certain degree, an amazing degree of anger in people, is because that's a defensive mechanism, because the existence of the self cannot be proven. It is a matter of belief, and therefore it is a belief that has to be defended. And that's where the violence comes from. I don't just mean physical violence. I mean it is a fundamental source of conflict for all of us. So it's very understandable that this is a complex subject that needs sensitive handling. I'll try to be as sensitive as I can about this. I think it's really, really helpful to distinguish the levels that we're talking about. So previously, in previous episodes of this, we've discussed how it is there's a conventional reality and an ultimate reality. So an example of the non-self nature of things that on the conventional level we talk about there being a car. But does a car have some absolute car nature, something which is integral and unique to a car? And of course, we understand that a car is a collection of parts and processes with an overarching purpose to it, to get us from A to B. We understand that there is nothing inherently car in a car. We understand that it is a collection of parts and processes. You take out the individual bits that go to make up a car, and you know, you take out the plastic, the metal, the fabric, the petroleum products, the grease, whatever it happens to the oil, and you say, is that inherently car? Does that have inherent car nature? And you say, no, that's a bit of plastic, that's a bit of wood, that's a bit of metal, that's a bit of fabric. It doesn't have inherent car nature. So we understand that we conceptualize and use a shorthand the notion of a car, knowing full well that it is a construction, an assembly of smaller parts. Okay. All right. So the level that we're talking about non-self is the level of these fundamental parts that go to make up conscious experience. And that we're not in dispute at all about the conventional reality where those fundamental parts combine, there's an interplay of forces, so there are parts and processes from which there is this emergent reality, and that we name and categorize and separate out into what we call the conventional reality of you, of me, of Bradford and Avon, of wherever it is that you happen to be today. And so that conventional reality is not touched at all. So nothing's going to change. You will still be you, and you will live your life. But what the exploration of the fundamental components does is it draws out all the passionate craving for life to be different, which is the cause of suffering. So you end up still getting to live your life, but free of the passion, the craving, the hatreds, the fears, the confusions, and so forth. Okay, so a couple of things that I thought about our notion of selfhood. So, okay, firstly, we can't actually prove the existence of the self. If it were possible to prove the existence of the self, we wouldn't have to go to all this bother and malarkey of practicing insight meditation. Okay, so it's an axiomatic assumption, but we can speculate on, were we to be able to locate the self, what kind of characteristics would it have? Now, what most people do is they say, well, my body is myself, or myself has feeling. So it's, they categorize it as feeling, or consciousness itself is, that is myself. Or mental formations like my loving nature, my creativity, my hatred, my lust. All these mental formations, they are that is myself. Or it might be one's knowledge, so one's ability to perceive in great detail in a particular subject. And they'll say, that knowledge, that is myself. Okay. What we do when we practice Vipassana meditation is we look at all those things, and we look at it in the same way we look at the car. And we say, well, does consciousness have self-nature? Do feelings have the nature of self? Are they fundamentally me or mine, actually, or not? And that's interesting, because if there is a self, what kind of characteristics would it have? Well, there are two main characteristics that occur to me. The self must be unchanging. Must be unchanging, and there must be full control and true dominion over it for it to be the self. So the first one of those is, like, it has to be unchanging, because if the self changes, if a characteristic of it changes, then how do you know it's the self? So if you're saying, yeah, well, that changes, but it belongs to the self, then you're saying the self is something else, and it's not that characteristic which can change. So, for instance, we can become accomplished at a skill that we didn't previously have. So we can't say that the development of that skill is self, because it is involved change. So the self has to be recognisable at all times. It can't be unchanging. It always has to be there. It must always be. So it cannot have the characteristic to change. So whatever characteristic it is, if you discover that whatever it is that you're looking at has the nature to change, then that has the characteristic of non-self, not self. You see what I mean? So it does not have the characteristic of self. The fact that it is changeable means that that characteristic is not self. And it must be under your complete control at all times. I remember a sutta that I found very useful when I was considering all this. The Buddha says to his monks, it's like, well, there was a fire burning close to them, and he looked at the flames and he said to the monks, can you control those flames? And the monks were like, well, no, we can't control those flames. They're not me, they're not mine, they're not myself. I don't have control over them, over the flames. And he said, well, it's just exactly the same with the rest of the five aggregates: materiality, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. And those are the fundamental building blocks that go to make up each and every conscious experience. Therefore, you don't ha you, in the same way as you don't have ultimate control over those external flames that you're looking at, so you don't have control over the five aggregates. And that's true. We don't have ultimate dominion and control over the body. If I had ultimate control and dominion over the body, I wouldn't have this body. I would have another body. I would have a much, much better body. I would certainly have a lot more hair on my head. And isn't one of the things, one of the key areas of neurosis in our modern culture is people's dissatisfaction with their own bodies. I went to the dentist for a checkup recently, and I had to fill out this questionnaire. And in the questionnaire it says, "Are you happy with the way your teeth look?" And I'm gonna have to do the rest of the interview, like the rest of the video, like this now, so you can't see my teeth because I don't have great teeth. I'm English, so I don't have great teeth. And I could spend thousands of pounds. Well, I couldn't spend thousands of pounds because I don't have thousands of pounds to spend on it, in making my teeth look all great and fantastic. But the only reason I would do that is out of a sense of dissatisfaction with the way I am. So I actually tick the box saying, yes, I was happy with the way my teeth are, because I have no intention in changing the way I look. It only really proves that the body is not self, because you don't have absolute dominion. And that's just looking at the conventional level. You don't have dominion over what goes on in your mind. You don't have control over mental formations. How many meditators have been plagued with unwanted thoughts in meditation? You don't have absolute dominion. And consciousness itself, we don't even know what consciousness is. The philosophers don't know what consciousness is. The scientists don't know what consciousness is. Nobody knows what consciousness is. So how can you have absolute dominion over something you don't even know what it is? Sorry, this is turning into a bit of a rant. But you get the point I'm trying to make. So when we look at ultimate phenomena, the fundamental components that go to make up each and every experience, we see that consciousness, the knowing of an object, is arising due to conditions. The object itself is arising due to conditions: a sound, a taste, a touch, a smell. Now, these are all the things that we go, yeah, it's me who tastes, it's me who touches, it's me who smells. And on the conventional level, that's fine. That's fine, and that's not going to be touched by any of this. But we're looking more deeply. We're going beyond the appearance of things and looking more deeply at what is actually taking place. And it's through that process of observing transience and the conditioned and conditioning nature of ultimate phenomena that you start to recognize the characteristic of not self, that things arise and pass away due to conditions, and that therefore whatever is looked at is seen and understood to have the nature of not self, to have the characteristic of not self. And so there is this extended exploration, which is it's not hunting for the self, because the self cannot be found. It is observing what is actually taking place. And it is it's with the completion of the Vipassana path that you come to see that the whole of existence can be noted and observed in its fundamental components, and the interplay between all those components can be observed to be transient, unsatisfactory, and non-self, and yet the interplay of all those phenomena go to make up conscious experience, and there was never a need for that additional concept, that additional construct of selfhood to make it all work. So people will say, well, if there's no self, how come I can hear? Well, hearing takes place. Hearing occurs without the need of a self. That's what you discover. There is hearing. There is no one who hears. There is seeing, but there is no one who sees. This is at the ultimate level. Conventionally, yeah, of course, we say yes. Yeah, I saw that, I heard that. But we're looking at the fundamental components, and it's here that we discover that there is no self required in order for experience to occur rightly. So that means that we are, in our ignorance, we are forever trying to, we've got every element that's required in order to make conscious experience, for conscious experience to occur, and then we're trying to push in this extra non-existent element and trying to insist that this extra element called the self is actually fundamental and absolute and, you know, and required in order for life to be complete. But it's not. So in a sense you could say, well, this is why everyone suffers, is because they're viewing everything, they're acting, assuming and trying to reinforce this sense of selfhood into experience. Now, through the process of Vipassana, you reach a point where you take that away completely, and what you're left with is just experience flowing happily, flowing freely, because what has been eliminated, it was that extra push of trying to insist upon something that doesn't have to be there for conscious experience to work fine. So it's unclogging the flow by letting go of the tenacious belief in the absolute nature of selfhood. So, because people get so scared, they think, oh, it means, oh, there's no consciousness. Either they think it's nihilistic, there's no consciousness, there's no feeling, but there is. There is. You retain your full creative capacities, your capacity for love, your capacity for compassion. You know, it's like, in that sense, life doesn't change at all. You still get to play out the drama of life completely. And now you can do it, though, without that same nagging insistence on selfhood. And as a final thought, you think about when you're happiest. I swear, whenever I ask people, it's always the same. When are you happiest, I say? And they say, it's when I'm playing with my granddaughter, or it's when I'm really stuck into a good book, or it's when I'm, you know, when I'm playing rugby, whatever it happens to be. All those times, the times when you're absorbed, and you're absorbed in what you're doing, and you are not self-obsessing. And when is life at its most congealed and difficult and torporish, and that you're most fractious? And it's always the times when you are self-concerned, when self-centeredness is uppermost. So the result of following this way and appreciating the characteristic of non-self is that it eliminates the self-regard that is manifested as craving for life to be different than it is. And that through the elimination of that confusion, what you're left with is just this wonderful flow, which includes, I should add, the quality of volition. So willing action into being. So there's another aspect where people say, well, that is myself. It is I that wills action. And what you discover is that no, volition is a quality which arises due to conditions, performs a function in the overall activities of conscious experience. Yes, it then causes other components of experience to occur. So it could be something as easy as there's the intention to open a door. Okay, that in order to perform the function, there has to be the willing. So there's the intention, there's the desire to do something, there's the intention, then there's the arising of volition, and then there's the performance of the action, so the arising of materiality to actually cause that to occur. So the volition cannot occur without the prior intent. Without the prior desire to do, the intent doesn't arise. Without the intent, the volition doesn't arise. And without the volition, the action isn't performed. And you see all this when you practice Vipassana. So, yes, so willing, volition, does occur, but it's not self. So, I think that'll do. That's 21 minutes, trying to keep them a bit shorter. So, yeah. So, in the next episode, I'll talk more about this flow that conscious experience actually has, because I think that'll be quite an interesting subject to consider. So I hope you enjoyed that, got something out of that. Till the next time.